Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we take a look at a little insect that we've talked about, a little animal we've talked about many times and had many questions about, the bee. Tom Seely, a professor of biology in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University, is a world-renowned researcher into the behavior and social life of honeybees. And he's written a number of books. His latest is titled Following the Wild Bee, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. And we'll be talking with him about that, of course. How do you trail a bee or trail bees to their hive? And also, obviously, quite a bit about their behavior as well. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. Have you ever followed a wild honeybee? What questions do you have at 1-800-642-1234? You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. And Thomas Seely, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry. It's really my pleasure to be with you today.
Well, it's really a lot of fun. And you've been studying bees for so long. I can see why it might fascinate you, but all for your career, you've been studying them. Why?
Well, they are, as you say, just utterly fascinating creatures. They form these colonies that function so well. It's almost like a Swiss watch, a bee colony. And figuring out how that works is a great mystery. And also now it's very important to understand how these colonies can live healthily under the current conditions. And that's part of what this story about hunting for wild colonies of honeybees is all about.
Yeah, and you've been doing it for a while now.
Yes, I started this some 40 years ago, looking for wild colonies of honeybees. Originally, it was just to indulge my curiosity. But more recently, with all of the health problems that honeybees have had, it's turned out to be very important to understand how the honeybee colonies that are living out in the wild, not managed by beekeepers, how they are doing. And it's turned out to be a fascinating story.
And the wild honeybees are, as I found out, not all that much different, or maybe not hardly any different, from the ones that are collected.
Yes. Yes and no, actually. There's a lot of exchange between the managed colonies, a genetic exchange between the managed colonies and the wild colonies, but in locations where there are not many beekeepers, so there are not many managed colonies, we've found that natural selection has been working hard to develop, to produce bees that have resistance to the mites and the viruses which are creating the big health problems for honeybees. So that's proved fascinating.
Boy, do you think there's any hope for breeding of the wild with the, I always want to call them tame, but they're not really tame, are they?
We call them managed colonies.
I've got to write that word down on a piece of paper here so I don't forget, but versus the managed colonies.
Yes, there is a great potential here. You see, what happened if we're breeding and using the features that natural selection has favored in the wild colonies, because natural selection is very powerful. In this case, it was exceedingly powerful. I've been studying a population of wild colonies around Ithaca, outside of Ithaca, New York, in the forests here, and we know now from their genetics that when the parasitic mite Varroa arrived here in the mid-1990s, the wild population was hit down to about 10% of its original level, but now it's bounced back, and the genetics of those bees has changed greatly, and presumably some of that has to do with their ability to resist the mite and the viruses that the mite transmits.
You wonder if there's any way to transmit that genetics to the managed colonies.
Oh, yes. There's a whole infrastructure for producing queen bees and doing controlled matings. And that that may well be the important future important step. Right now, we're still, however, at the stage of, well, we've documented that these wild colonies can survive without chemical treatments. Our next step is to understand what it is. Is it just their genetics, or is it their environmental conditions? In other words, is it not just who these bees are, but how they live that's enabling them to survive?
Yeah, you wonder. But the in those places where we have both managed and wild in the same place, the genetics are fairly similar, are they not?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's correct. That's right. And that has to do with how honeybees have sex. When a queen mates, she flies out of her hive, flies off a mile or more, and then mates with the drones that she finds in one of these special mating areas. And those males, the drones, can come from any colony around. So there's a really lots of mixing up of the genes of all the colonies in an area.
Is it then harder for someone, say in this area of the world, where you, at least in southern Wisconsin, where you don't have big forests, is it hard to follow a bee, follow the bees to their nest?
You know, actually, I'd say where you are, where it's more open, that's a real that facilitates things greatly. What gets really hard is when you. The way you start a bee hunt is you capture bees off of a patch of flowers, and then you line them, you track them back to their nest. And in the forest setting, that can be a challenge, but you have to jump from clearing to clearing in the forest. But if you're out in a more open area, then you could have good clear views probably all the way along your hunt.
And the wild bees are quite adept at, hey, I'm going to take the easier approach here, too. I remember a story in your book about following the bees down a road for quite a way.
Yeah.
It kind of threw you off a little bit on your trailing.
Oh, you read the book really well. Yes, that's right. Yeah, sometimes you have to be pretty careful in interpreting what you see from the bees, because the bees, yes, just as you said, if they can find a low energy or easy way home, even if it's not the most direct route, they'll take that, and that can be misleading to you about what is their direction home.
Really?
So it's a real craft.
Yeah,
I was just going to say you go.
Go ahead.
This bee hunting is it's another really fun way to enjoy honeybees. And as you know, and you mentioned at the beginning of the show, the popularity and interest of people in this amazing insect, Apis mellifera, has grown. And almost everybody thinks the only way to indulge that interest is to take up beekeeping. But I wrote this little book to show people another way, bee hunting, to have fun with honeybees.
And it is a fascinating read. I tell you that. Ray in Rhinelander has a question, so let's go there. Ray, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi. Thank you, Larry, and thank you for your guest. This is really exciting. This really gets me going, because I spent a lot of time out in the woods and stuff in northern Wisconsin. And it was on my property and the other day, and it borders a black spruce swamp with tamaracks, and then there's some high rolling hills, and there's a few areas that are open. But I noticed in this area, I was sitting there eating my lunch, and of course enjoying the day, and all these, there was about eight honeybees around me on the raspberry bushes and blackberry bushes on the flowers.
Beautiful.
And I'm looking at these bees, and they were much more mellower the way they moved, and I actually was able to pet a bunch of them, and they didn't, there was no hassle with that, you know. So my main question is when people say that there is it's wildflower honey or it's organic, how true is that? Because from what I'm listening to, what this person is saying and how they move about and stuff, how can that be? And genetically, are these stronger? You've covered a lot of this, but I'm also turning into a bee hunter now, and I'm trying to find these little bees where they go, and you're right, it can be really challenging, but to see them in the middle of nowhere, like in Iron County and other places, what's the health of that? I know I threw a lot at you, but I'll trust you can sort it out, and I'll take it off here, and thanks
right.
a lot again.
Thanks a lot, Ray. Yeah, and stay listening, Ray, because we're going to go into more details on the actual hunting as well, but go ahead, Tom.
Well, first I want to say thank you, Ray, for sharing with us your observations of finding honeybees out in the middle of nowhere, probably far from any beekeepers' hives. Then what you've got there is a wonderful example of how honeybees are thriving in the wild. Many people thought, understandably, given the high mortality of honeybee colonies that are kept by beekeepers, that all the wild colonies died off. And as I mentioned earlier, they went through a population bottleneck. The population did crash, but it has built back up, especially in these remote places where there is nobody treating the colonies. And so selection worked very, very strongly. And so the gentleman has a great place to go bee hunting. His question about wildflower honey, those bees would indeed be making wildflower honey. The only sources of flowers they probably have available are wildflowers, no managed crops or anything like that. So I wish I could go bee hunting with you, Ray. I'm sure we'd have fun together. I'd love to learn about your part of your neck of the woods.
Yeah, I bet you guys would have fun together. And there's a few things that you need to have at your disposal, I think, to make the whole process a little easier for somebody like Ray or me or anybody else.
Well, yes, the first item that you'll need is a copy of my book, because that'll explain, gives you detailed
exactly
instructions.
Right. With some pretty good photos as well.
Yes. Well, anyhow, after plugging that, I'll mention that the pieces of equipment you need are really, really simple. The only thing that's unusual is the bee box. It's a little box. This is a little box that you build, and it's a device whereby you can capture bees off flowers and introduce them efficiently to a small square of comb, or it could be a piece of bread that contains either diluted honey or some sugar syrup. And with that little device, you then trap the bees, you introduce them to this free lunch, and then what do you need beyond that? Well, you need, once you've caught the bees, you let them go. And so at that point, you'll need a watch, and you'll need a notebook, and you'll need a compass so you can sight the direction that the bees are going and record that. And then you need a few couple of paint pens are really handy, because you want to label some of those bees so you can get their round trip times. And that gives you a pretty good indication of just how far away their home is out there in the woods.
And Ray, as Ray said, he was petting them, and it's not that difficult to actually mark those bees. I saw you have a nice photo in your book marking a bee.
Yeah, again, thank you for reading the book so closely. And right, when those bees have been introduced to your wonderful free lunch, that's this bonanza food source, they are intent on slurping up that sugar syrup or diluted honey. And so you can touch them with your paintbrush or your paint pen, and they're not disturbed at all.
Talking today with Tom Seeley. Thomas Seeley is the author of many books, including the one we're talking about today. It's called Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. And so you'll learn all about hunting them, but you'll also learn a whole lot about bees in the process of reading the book. I can tell you that for free. You may have a question or comment. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler, Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mehler here. Great to have you with us as we talk about Following the Wild Bees. That's the title of the book by Thomas Seeley. Join in again at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Just to let you know, coming up at 2, Kathleen Dunn will take a look at the upcoming vote in Britain that will decide if they stay in the European Union and what that may mean if they decide to leave. So that coming up, but right now we're focusing in on bees. And Steve in Boulder Junction, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a lot of bees buzzing around some raspberry plants that I've got, and earlier they were around some fruit trees. And I was hoping that they were mason bees. I've heard that they're good for pollination. They'll fly on days when honeybees won't and so on. But I don't know how to tell if they're mason bees or wild honeybees. And I'd like to keep them around for many years. Mason bees, I understand you can make a little house for them with some little tubes that look like empty cigarette tubes, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So how do I tell which one they are, and how do I keep them coming back every year?
Yeah, the honeybee is just one of several hundred species of bees that live in North America, so it can be a little tricky. I'd say the best way to tell the difference is to get one of the guidebooks. There's a really good one on the identification of the North American bees of all of North America. It's published by Princeton University Press. The precise name escapes me right now, but I think it's called Bees in Your Backyard, Identifying Bees in Your Backyard. That really is the way to do it, because the mason bee is just one of, as I say, hundreds of species of non-honeybees that exist with us.
And thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Janet and McQuanigo next. Hi, Janet. Thanks for calling.
Hi. One of the most fascinating things I've ever seen happened a few years ago. In August, I have a stand of Joe Pye weed, and I went out in the morning to the garden early in the morning, and there were hundreds of bees sleeping on the individual little flower buds. On the Joe Pye weed has about a 12-inch flower head, and each one had their legs curled around an individual little flower, and they were sleeping there. Were those wild bees?
Yeah, those were not honeybees. All honeybees go home to sleep at night, but there are many of the non-honeybees do spend the night out. Mostly, it's males. They don't have a nest to return to. Females generally go back to their nests, but sometimes even the females get caught out at night and will just camp out for the night.
There we go.
Nice sight.
Yeah, amazing sight. Thank you, Janet, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Well, they, you know, getting lost, or probably they just, it got dark. Do they use sight in a way? How do they, you describe this pretty well in your book, but how do they find their way back and forth?
Bees are really good navigators, and they do have to have good skills in finding their way back and forth, because a bee ranges, a worker honeybee, for example, ranges from her hive or nest out several miles. And the way she does it is she uses two techniques. One is what we call piloting, and it's keeping track of the direction she's flying. When she's leaving her nest, she keeps track of the distance. The direction she's going and the distance, so that when she wants to come home, she knows what direction to fly back and how far to fly back. And the other thing that she does is she memorizes the location of her hive, what the look of her hive looks like. So when she gets back to the right location, the right vicinity of her hive, she has mental snapshots of what her hive looks like, and she just keeps flying around until she finds a match between what she saw when she left the hive and what she's seen presently. And through those two techniques, she'll find her way, she can find her way home.
And she then, if she's found, let's say, your box with with the hive, with the syrup or whatever in it, it's fascinating how she tells the others to come along with her.
That's one of the most remarkable experiences the bee hunter has. He or she captures a bee off of flowers in the field far from wherever the bee's home is. The bee gets loads up, goes home, is away for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and even before she returns to your little food source, your little feeding station, other bees start appearing there. And that's because that first bee has sent others, has shared with others the information about the location. She does that with a behavior called the waggle dance.
Where she can indicate, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, she indicates the direction to this bonanza and the distance, and she's also carrying home your food, which you've scented, as I'll explain in the book, and that helps the other bees once they're in the right general location to zero in on your food source.
They know the scent.
Yep.
And yep. you put, what is it you put in addition to the syrup or whatever, you add a dash of,
It's anise. It's anise extract. Like you can buy it in the grocery store, a little bottle of McCormick's anise extract. And that's a scent that the bees, we're not sure whether the bees are exceedingly sensitive to it or they find it inherently attractive, but by lacing your bait with that, it really makes it work, makes it very attractive. The bees find it very easily.
It brings them in. Well, let's go to Gene and Madison next with something. Hi, Gene. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I have a question concerning the studies that they've done in Europe, like France and in Denmark and the like, concerning glyphosate and the effect of GMO material on bees and the effect that it appears GMOs have had on America. And I'm just curious as to why do the Europeans want to ban glyphosate?
Yeah, it's a little bit outside my area of expertise. I don't follow the whole pesticide story really closely. It is a little puzzling. Glyphosate is an herbicide, and it, to the best of my knowledge, it's not toxic to honeybees or other insects. So I can't give you a good answer for that. Probably my guess would be there's some evidence that it's carcinogenic, so people are having some second thoughts about the safety of that herbicide.
Kenneth in Janesville called in to ask what locations have been the resurgence of the wild honeybees. Is it all in the U.S. or elsewhere?
It's been elsewhere as well. There are, I have a colleague that works in southern France, and he reports in the forested areas there around Avignon. There are the wild honeybees exist out in the forests again. There's evidence that they also exist in other remote places in Europe, such as northern Scotland, the highlands of Scotland. Certainly they're up in not just in the woods of New York State, but I hunt them in Connecticut, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. So they're up in the wilds of New England as well. A good challenge will be to start looking at other areas in the whole eastern deciduous forest area. I estimate, knowing the area of that forest and knowing the density of these wild colonies, at least for around my place, which is about 2.5 wild colonies per square mile, that there are as many wild colonies, again, as there are managed colonies, at least in this eastern deciduous forest region. And probably up in the northern forest region, like you've got in northern Wisconsin.
Absolutely. We sure hope so, anyway. Jerry in Toma has something. Hi, Jerry. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, and to you and your guest. I happened to tune into the program, and I grew up in Beaumont, Texas, which is on the southeast coast of Texas. And back in the early 60s, I was born in 53, and I convinced my father to get me a beehive. And I'm African-American, so it was really a rare scene for my friends to come by the house and see, what in the world is that? And mm-hmm. I got the inclination about bees from a friend of mine whose father was a beekeeper. And so I got a hive, and I still can remember, as your guest was speaking and yourself, I can still smell the honey. And we had a 150-foot by 40, and it was sitting all the way on the back. And it was such a joy to go in to see the bees doing what they do best. And what I did was I had a table, and as your guest was referring about the sugar syrup, the sugar water, I would rotate and move the table around and document when the bees would, how they would find it, run to the hive, open the top, and watch the bee do the bee dance. And sure enough, no matter where I moved that table, it might have taken a little bit, but where there was one bee, it would be 15, 20, 30. And unfortunately, my father worked in the post office, and his head was shaved. I was at school when I came home one day and was right to the beehive, and lo and behold, it was gone. So my mom told me that he went back there, and for some whatever reason, I guess the sweat, she looked out, and he hollered up, throw down the blanket. And my beehive was gone. And so at that time, I lost my interest. I was so heartbroken. But I still remember ordering those, you know, those old wonderful catalogs back in the day. And my first European queen bee came in a little box. And I was so overwhelmingly excited.
You know, Jerry, it's interesting. Here's a guy, Ken, who's or Tom, excuse me, who has observed the directions. What a great scientific little community science.
Yeah. I can share with you the excitement of the old Sears or Montgomery Ward catalog that sold bee supplies in it, and you could order a queen bee. Yeah, those were wonderful times. I'm sorry that you lost your colony. Hopefully you can start up another one soon.
There you go.
Well, I've never lost my excitement for it. And for some encouragement for you, if people were more like bees, I was reading an article, and it was about a young man from Iraq. His dad was a beekeeper, and he followed suit, and the ISIS group came one day, and they told him beekeeping was no longer allowed, and his father refused, and they murdered his father.
Oh.
And so he came to the USA, and I was just reading yesterday an article about this beekeeper in Los Angeles, and he has kept the tradition going, and lo and behold, he cannot keep up with the demand for him to come and retrieve bees from people's homes. And
very, very interesting. And I have a friend, as a matter of fact, who has some bees. I guess you'd say they're wild bees, but they've taken up residence in a barn.
Yes, that's right. The wild bees live in our buildings as well as in trees, and in many parts of the country, that's another indication of how the wild honeybee population has surged back, particularly in the southern states where there's the Africanized bee has always had good resistance to the mites and the viruses.
And Jerry, thanks again for calling. I want to give our other listeners a chance to join in. You can visit with us at 1-800-642-1234 as we talk bees and following the wild bees with our guest Thomas Seeley. That's the author, or that's the title of his book, Following the Wild Bees: The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. We started talking about what you need, and you talked about a box, and you have a nice photo, some nice photos in your book of the box, and you mentioned some other things that you need, but not very much.
Right. This is really, and that's one of the features of bee hunting, and it contrasts with beekeeping. If you want to do beekeeping, you usually have to lay out a fair amount of money just to get the hive, to get the bee suit, to get your hive tool and smoker. All of those things, none of those things are needed for bee hunting. You don't need to suit up when you're bee hunting because you're not disturbing the bees. When you're a beekeeper, like I am, you open up a hive, you're actually opening up and disturbing the nest, and the bees are defensive. So you need to suit up, you have to smoke the bees. Bee hunting, you're working gently and calmly with the bees. In fact, you're not disturbing it at all, you're rewarding them, you're giving them something great. So the bees are gentle, you don't have to worry about being stung, and you're not providing them with a home, they've already got a home, so you don't have to have a hive. All you really, you can equip yourself with, for about, I don't know, $25, $30, especially if you already have a compass. That's probably the most expensive thing you need.
Somebody's got if you have a GPS in your phone, maybe that would work.
Right. Yeah, that's right. With the iPhone, it's really fun because you can plot out where you are on the using the GPS, and then step by step as you move closer to the nest, you can track your progress. One thing I want to stress about bee hunting too is that it's the pleasure. It's one of these situations. It's a form of hunting where the fun is in the chase because there's no kill to bee hunting. It used to be people have been bee hunting for, probably 50,000 years, as long as people have been people. But historically, it was done, as it's still done by hunter-gatherer peoples, to get honey. And I'm not advocating going out and tracking down wild colonies of bees to steal their honey. That's what used to be done, but it's so much better and easier to get honey by buying it from a beekeeper. So the key point is that there's no kill in bee hunting. The fun is in the chase. And anybody that's, I don't know, most people that have been hunting, whatever they are, they will understand that message. There's a huge amount of pleasure just in the chase.
And, you know, I thought as I was reading, I thought, I wonder if there's a certain tree or a certain species of tree, but... you know, judging from your photos and so forth, that's not the determining factor in a colony of wild bees setting up a nest.
That's right. We don't have any signs that they have a preference of tree species when they choose their home sites in the wild. What we do know is they're very selective in other regards, however. Things like they like the entrance high off the ground. That's very important to them. That gives them a lot of safety from black bears, for example. They also need the cavity to be quite spacious so they have enough room to store up the honey they need to get through the winter. Bees store up so much honey because they survive winter by clustering inside their nest and generating heat, and the honey is their heating fuel for that heat production. And they also like the entrance to be small so they can guard it easily. So they're pretty picky, but not with respect to tree species.
No, they certainly aren't. And you have a great photo of one tree where the hive is way up in the tree.
Yes, I've kept careful track of the heights of the entrances of the trees that I find by bee lining. And yes, the average is about 10 meters or some 30 feet off the ground. These bees like to live high. And that was a surprise because when I first started doing this, people would tell me, oh, I found a bee tree here, found a bee tree there. And many of them were low to the ground, but that was a consequence of those were the hives people would notice. When you go bee hunting, you're sampling regardless of entrance height. And then you discover, oh, these bees like to nest high up in the trees.
Here's Martin in Duluth with a question. Hi, Martin. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a few acres in the western part of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And is it possible for me to establish a nest so I can attract wild bees to form a colony there? I just, of course, noticed that you say they like them up high and I could build a stand. Has that been done or is that feasible?
Oh, yes. Thank you for asking that question. There's three ways to enjoy bees. One is beekeeping. One is bee hunting. The third, and this is where your question is in bee trapping. And for this, you build a bait hive. And it's a simple box. It's about ideally, if you want to match the bees' housing preferences, you build it out of maybe 3/4-inch plywood. A little more than a cubic foot in volume. You put a 1 1/4-inch diameter opening in it, so it's kind of like a birdhouse on steroids, and you mount it up in a tree at least 10 or so feet off the ground, and that's a great way to attract a wild colony of bees. And it's actually how I get almost all of my bees these days, by putting out these so-called bait hives.
And do you then put something in the, you know, honey or something in the inside, or?
No, in fact, you don't want to put honey in, but you could. There are things called swarm lures that are sold by bee supply companies, and those are a little bit of a pheromone that is the assembly or attraction pheromone that the scout bees use once they find a site to attract other members of their other scout bees from their swarm to that site.
And your research is focused on this whole phenomenon of swarm intelligence. Would you explain that? Talk about that?
Yeah, that's what I worked on for about 15 years, and it's the process whereby the bees in a honeybee swarm, and a honeybee swarm is a reproductive propagule from a bee colony, how they go about choosing their home site. And it's a plebiscite process or a democratic process whereby the swarm has about 10,000 bees in it, and about 5% of them, or about 500 of those bees, function as the bees that choose the swarm's, the colony's new home. They fly out, search independently for cavities like we were just talking about, and Each bee, those bees that find a prospective home site, evaluate it, inspect it, evaluate it, and come back and advertise their discovery using this waggle dance that we talked about. And a competition then starts for which one will be the new home. They typically will find 10 or 20 possible home sites. And the bees have a very elegant mechanism of deciding which one will be their new home, and it's such an elegant mechanism, it almost always identifies the best option out of the 10 or 20 or so that they're looking at. And it's a little tricky to explain, but it's the heart of it is that bees adjust how persistently they perform the waggle dance as a function of the goodness of the site that they have discovered. So the best sites get advertised at the swarm to other scout bees the most strongly, and interest will build up fastest at the best site. And once interest builds up to a critical level, the scouts recognize, oh, that site has been chosen, and then they will organize a move to that site.
That is just amazing.
it is amazing, and you, I've written about that in another book, and it's remarkably the logic of how that decision making process works. It's what we call an information race, is a lot like how our nervous system makes decisions as well. So it's a very good system for taking in information about different options and identifying the best one.
So it's kind of like human behavior then.
Yeah, it's like how our brains, for example, we might be in a situation where we hear a sound and we want to know whether it's from the left or from the right. And what happens is the neurons that are getting information from, let's say it's stronger from the left, it really has come from the left. The neurons in your left ear report more vigorously on sound than those from the right ear, and information builds up in your brain that, okay, it takes a few milliseconds for the brain that, okay, the signal really is stronger from the left, so that is the one we're going to go with. And so that's the way it works with a swarm. The evidence builds up. This site over here to the west is better than the one over to the east, and we'll go to that one.
And Thomas, just to conclude here, if you're going to, and I hope people have a chance to look at your book and read your book, if you were going to say why should anyone go out and follow the wild bees, what would you tell them?
It's fun. It's fun. And you'll learn a lot about bees. It's fun as a human experience, but it's also a really strong learning experience because you're working closely with individual bees. Remember, you've labeled them with paint marks. It's not just looking down at 10,000 bees, which is the experience you have in beekeeping. You're looking at individuals, and you learn their personalities, and you see their quirks, and you watch their behavior as they load up with their food, as they clean themselves up, and as they fly off and fly home, and then as they land. And some are nervous Nellies, and some are really bold bees. It's great. It's a great experience, a very strong learning, and fun, takes you outdoors. All of the things that go with hunting, bee hunting provides, plus you're dealing with this really cool insect. So that's in a nutshell.
Tom, I hope we have a chance to talk again. It's been a very enjoyable time visiting with you, and thank you so much for being with us today.
You're so welcome, Larry. It's been my pleasure, top to bottom.
Thomas Seeley is the author of Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. What a fascinating book. It was so great to talk with him. Well, we had flying insects. Next, we are going to turn to another flying thing. This time, the sea duck and some other waterfowl, as we visit with Craig and Nicole Swenson, who established the Flyways Waterfowl Museum in Baraboo back in 2013. That coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.